Hello, my name is Christoph Nines, and I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hello, Ilya, and welcome back to the United States.
Hey, thanks. It's good to be back.
Yeah, you were in Korea for 2 weeks. Kay's filled in for you for 2 weeks. He's kind of our official Joan Rivers here at the podcast.
I'm glad Kay's could do that. He's got a unique perspective, and I'm sure that he did all kinds of contradicting everything that you said, which is perfect.
It's what he does in real life too. Hey, if he's Joan Rivers, does that make Bill Totolo Jerry Seinfeld or Gary Shandling?
Probably Gary Shandling, but yes, you're right.
Yeah. Hey, it's a reference no one under the age of 50 will get. Anyway.
Hey, Ben, who's on the show today?
It is Christoph Nguyens, an interview that you conducted with the DP of season 2 of Andor.
That's right. There's a few season 2 DPs, but Christoph did the bulk of it, and we get into a lot of it. We talk all about the show. It's a great conversation, and it'll be coming up in just a couple of minutes. But first, we have our close focus.
Oof. And now, close focus.
There's definitely some things going on in the industry right now, but something that you and I were discussing just before hitting record on this episode was the new Guillermo del Toro Frankenstein movie made for Netflix.
And moreover, you pointed me to a Hollywood Reporter article that brings up something called the Roadhouse Paradox, which is about streamers and features and what happens when they make a feature that is good enough for theaters. Roadhouse is a good example. I might have even gone for Prey, the Predator sequel, or prequel, or whatever you want to call it, which is a movie that I would argue if you put Prey in theaters today, it would make $20 million. Like it was released on streaming 4 years ago. Roadhouse, obviously a big one, which was directed by Doug Liman and starred Jake Gyllenhaal, and I believe Amazon Prime just dumped on streaming, much to Doug Liman's consternation out loud. And, Del Toro has a relationship with Netflix. He made his stop motion Pinocchio for them. And I am an unabashed nerdy fanboy of Guillermo del Toro. I think he's one of the best filmmakers working today and possibly ever. And it does kind of bum me out that his Frankenstein adaptation, which is one of his dream projects, is going straight to streaming. And we won't have a chance to see it in theaters, especially when, we all know that Greta Gerwig's Narnia, which is also being made for Netflix, is getting released not just in theaters, but supposedly going to be released on IMAX screens. So, but Ted Sarandos, CEO of Netflix, has repeatedly said that theatrical is not the future of movies. And I heartily disagree and have repeatedly talked about how much I love the theatrical experience here. And I think this summer is kind of proving it right, that if there is sufficient stuff to go see in the theaters, people will crowd those theaters and see it in the theaters. And actually, the problem is that these streaming services have short windows that make people go, oh, I didn't see it in the theater. If I wait 3 weeks, it'll be streaming somewhere. And they kind of need to say, hey, we did what we had to do to get through COVID. And now let's open up these windows and give people a reason to go back to theaters. What say you? I've been doing a lot of talking.
You described it. You described it really well. But the paradox, the Roadhouse paradox, is that if a movie isn't particularly very good, it'll be justified for going straight to streaming. If the movie is really good, then it won't be justified for going straight to streaming. There is money to be made from the theatrical experience. There are people who want it, and Netflix and some of the other streamers are not necessarily giving it, or not giving quality movies a chance. And I think it has everything to do with Ted Sarandos's vision of the future, which seems actually, as far as I'm concerned, a little bit murky, trying to incorporate podcasts, trying to incorporate something more like YouTube or user-generated, quote-unquote, content. We don't really know what that's going to look like yet, but I do know one thing. Podcasts and UGC is not movies. Movies are a theatrical experience. Movies might be seen at home, but yeah. Movies are very, very.
Yeah, obviously, we're all for podcasts. Look at what we're doing right now. Yeah. Novels aren't paintings. Music isn't ballet. Like, let each form be its own thing.
You know, you might like long walks on the beach, and that would distract you from going to see a movie. But it's not that the things are interchangeable or the same. It's like, yes, there's other things competing for, humans' attention in 2025. But if you want humans' attention for movies, you just have to make the best movies possible. And maybe Netflix shouldn't say that they're really in the movie business then, if what they're going to do is not actually put things in theaters.
Yeah, I mean, it is a movie. It's like a TV movie. It's like a movie of the week. And the thing is that Guillermo del Toro is someone who doesn't make movies of the week. Guillermo del Toro makes, when he's on, he makes freaking Pan's Labyrinth. And he has a series that he did for a season with Netflix called Cabinet of Curiosities, which is like a perfectly cool series. I think that this is my theory, and I'll probably get made fun of. Direct all your email at me, people who want to make fun of me for saying this. I think people miss seeing movies in the theater, and part of it is that we have we don't do our shopping in stores. We do our shopping online. We don't go to bookstores, and although bookstores actually are on the rise, bookstores are doing really well lately. But we don't go to music stores. We don't buy our music at stores anymore. We don't gather. We don't do things as a crowd anymore. And movies is one of the last things that we can do as a crowd. And I always, when people complain about the cost of movies, I always counter with, name one cheaper thing you can do out at night. You can't even go get a nice dinner for cheaper than going to a movie. And if you don't like the movies that are out, you don't like the movies that are out. I get it. No one's saying you have to go do it. That's on the part of the studios and the people who are creating these movies, the indies and whatever, the distributors, to curate and give us the best stuff. And I feel like generationally that changes. The tastes evolve and change. And so sometimes they're playing catch up with what the current audience wants. But, like this summer, for instance, Lilo and Stitch was originally supposed to be made for streaming. That was going to be released on Disney Plus. And now I think it's rounding around $200 million theatrically. It had one of the biggest theatrical grosses for an opening weekend. Disney's had that a couple of times. Moana 2 was going to be a season of a TV series, and then they repackaged it, turned it into a movie, and it made $1 billion in theaters. People want to go see movies in theaters. And I do think that as COVID is old news now, and people are more and more wanting to go do stuff in public with other people. And it's not surprising that, the new Mission Impossible, I think, is the second worst one of the whole series, and it's still doing really well. And I think it's because people really want to see that big thing on that big screen.
It's really interesting. I would say that in the land of multiplexes, there really should be more emphasis on art house revival, sort of old second run movies that I still think people would rather go see sometimes than the current crop of offerings that are listed, especially since there's so many screens that are available. And look, there are still art houses. There are still revival screens all across this country. In Portland, there is an IMAX screen that basically is sort of like revival IMAX. And they do show some non-IMAX stuff on it. But like, it's really phenomenal. And they pack them in. They sell out those shows. It's like, if you have a premium experience for people and there's something that's really beloved and you program it, people will turn out.
I don't understand why we don't do more retrospective screenings. I mean, and this is an LA thing, but literally tonight, and I'm going to make you so jealous when I tell you this right now, get ready. You're going to be so freaking jealous that you're not in LA.
Is it the
Miller's Crossing at the Egyptian? the Coen Brothers, Miller's Crossing. And we bought tickets over a month ago. It is sold out. The Egyptian is, I don't know exactly how many seats it is, but I bet it's around 1,000 and it's sold out.
I think that LA gets dismissed because of things like that, because, oh, it's LA. Oh, you can only do that in LA. I disagree. I really disagree. I think that anywhere you've got a community of people who like the arts, people who really appreciate, you know, quality movies, you can do exactly the same thing.
My hometown theater, the Enzian Theater in Maitland, Florida, that is, I used to be a projectionist and a manager there. I was just in Florida just a few weeks ago. And I stopped by there and they're showing all these cool retrospective screenings, some of them in 35, and they're packing the place. And that's, you know, a small suburb of Orlando, a sleepy suburb of Orlando. And yes, I agree. I think that people love this stuff, and maybe it's our generation loves it a little bit more than Gen Z or Gen Alpha or whatever, but or the millennials. But I do think that there's a love of it, and we want to see a beloved movie with great sound mix, and we want to see it with a crowd. I mean, can you imagine the audience that sold out a screening of Miller's Crossing, not the Coen's most popular movie, but one of my personal favorites? The people who are in there, we are hanging on every word of that movie. You know, like every line of dialogue, we're going to get bigger laughs than we've ever gotten, because I haven't seen that movie in the theater since it came out in whatever, 1991 or whatever. But to me, like, this all speaks to the theatrical experience. And I think what is a fundamentally incorrect presumption by Ted Sarandos, who in many ways is a brilliant innovator and has done incredible things for the entertainment industry, but also wants to steer it away from theaters, which is where I think a lot of people want to see stuff.
You're giving me the high hat.
Take your flunky and dangle.
Yeah. Oh, only fans of...
Well, yeah. If you get nothing else from this close focus, go watch Miller's Crossing. It's one of the greatest films.
Exactly right. All right. So Ben, let's get to the interview with Christoph Nunez.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by Christoph Nunez. Did I say that their name correctly?
Nunez, but it's difficult. So don't bother.
Hey, I've got a difficult name, so I know exactly what it's like to try to order a pizza. So hey, welcome to the Cinematography Podcast. You have a series on Disney Plus right now called Andor, and season two, you've shot the first third of the show. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, so I don't know if I've ever had an interview with someone who had the unique challenge of kicking off season two of a show that also has to, I would assume, carry looks over from season one and also carry over some looks from the feature, Rogue One, that's supposed to take place right after this series ends. Can you talk a little bit about how you were able to manage all these different, you know, restrictions on your work?
Well, to start off with, I didn't see it as restrictions, because season one was really beautiful, I think. And Rogue One is one of my favorite Star Wars movies. So it's just a nice way in, actually. I think, of course, I rewatched season one and also Rogue One, and I just took it in, but I didn't really try to look too much at both. For me, the most important, the thing I changed the most was it's something technical for me. It's Season one was shot on the Panavision C series on the Venice on a prop sensor.
Yeah.
And I wanted to expand it a little bit towards Rogue One, which was shot on Alexa 65. So I decided to go and look for full frame anamorphics and to shoot full frame on the camera to have a bit more scope and to grow a little bit towards Rogue One. And I think the other thing I tried to do was to keep it a bit natural light-wise and to don't make it too a sci-fi fantasy. I think for me it was important that it stayed a bit natural like Rogue One and the first season. So I think those are the main things that I try to do to be in between the, both of them.
Yeah, I think it was really successful. I think you really did nail it. So it feels very much like the continuation. And then by the time you get to the end of the series too, it feels, yeah, I would say there's maybe more difference with Rogue One because, of course, it was shot so many years ago.
And
the character, the lead actor of Andor is younger and everything else. But there's a pretty consistent look and feel through the whole thing. Did you have to be very conscious when you're going through it? Where at certain points you're thinking like, I know I've done my pre-production work, I know I've set this up, but did you at any point start to feel like, oh, I need to tone this down or I need to add to this to try to make this a smoother transition? Was that in your mind at all?
No, not really. It went all quite organic. And I think it's also especially because this show has so many different worlds and sets. And every world has a different look. With all those, So every planet had its own look. For example, Minerva, Chandrila. Minerva was sunny. Chandrila was quite shiny and chic. Then you had Gorman, which was darker and like a town in the mountains with blue light all the time. So we had all our different sets, and that was really nice to play with those things to create all those little different moods. I think when we found our look and our the way we want to go, we just kept on going. And
definitely, it feels very consistent. So one of the things that really struck me, though, about Andor, season one and season two, but your work, particularly getting into it, it feels real. It doesn't have the feeling quite so often of other shows that are utilizing virtual sets and virtual production. Everything feels very real. It feels like, you know, he's really stealing the TIE interceptor. He's really doing all of these things. Was a lot of the sets, how did you guys, give the feeling of reality so often? Were you on incredible stages? To pull back the curtain, tell us a little bit about how production actually took place.
For production, that was really important also. So most of the sets were big builds, actually. For example, like you mentioned, the TIE Avenger in the beginning, it was shot in a stage, but the stage, almost the whole stage was filled against the walls with a build set. So we had a lot of set to work with. For example, other sets, the wedding, the ballroom in the wedding. We even used painted backings to have everything in camera. So every time it was possible, we tried to get everything in camera without. And I think the advantage of that is that you can make it feel natural. For example, the wedding outside, instead of green screens, we had a painted backing, which was good for me because I could light naturally. I could overexpose outside. I could use flares, Atmos. All those things are quite difficult if you're working with green screens. The safe house in the second three episodes, so 4, 5, and 6. We used the LED wall outside, but it was just outside to have the view on Coruscant. Also LED, because of that, we could use rain. There are shots from outside. We're outside. You see the reflection of the city in the window with raindrops. Mm. All those things are extremely difficult if you're working with green screens. And I think together with Luke Hull and Amon Leo, Luke Hull is the production designer and Amon Leo is the VFX supervisor. We always tried to find the good balance between something that felt real and something that was practically possible.
Yeah.
Also, I think Mo and Leo is so good with his approach to the VFX. For him, it was also every time really important that everything felt grounded and respected the natural laws. And I think, yeah, it's so important in VFX.
For sure. What's your approach to lighting, to taking on a show like Andor?
I think I approached it like I was shooting on real sets on location almost. So I think it's always the best way to do, because then it feels natural. I don't like sets where you can take all the walls and there's no ceiling, or you can take this away the ceiling, because then you start putting lights where it's not possible actually. So I really approached it like I would light a real set on location. I think that's the, yeah, for me, that's the main catch in working in stages, just to approach it like, yeah, like normal.
Gotcha. And so I know you worked a lot with Ariel Kleeman for the show. Did you guys have a lot of conversations early on about camera movement and how you wanted to transition from point A to point B? Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with the director and basically coming up with the ideas for how the camera should exist in the world of season 2?
Yeah, the first 2 weeks of our prep. And it was the first time we met each other.
Oh, wow.
So we start reading the scripts we start reading the scripts together and making notes and ideas. We both of us started making mood boards, and then we were pitching them to each other, talking about favorite movies, watching movies together, looking through photo books and really making I think between a director and a DP, it's really important to talk visually, and we did it by showing pictures and bits of movies, and this is something I really like, and then I think by doing that you start learning each other and learning to know each other, then from the moment we start really blocking the scenes. For us, it was important that it didn't feel too classical, shot, reverse shot. Our goal was to shoot every scene with the least amount of shots. Just don't overdo it, because then really quickly it feels like coverage. And the good thing is that Andor is a show that allows that, and Tony Gilroy likes also that way of telling a story.
Yeah, there's a minimalist sort of quality to the show, which is kind of funny to say, because there's so much going on the screen but there's a real economy of shots. So that was a conscious decision from the beginning. That was okay. I got to imagine then. Are you only giving the editor one way? Do you guys decide really early, like this is how it's going to be, or do you end up doing a lot of extra coverage when you work minimally? So, no,
we didn't do that. It's very rare that they allow it on a show actually, but we did it. It was minimal coverage. We did a lot of takes to nail it. But we didn't do a lot of coverage, and it's really a way I like to work, because then you're really working towards something that's precise. For example, in all the crosscuts, at the end of episode 3, for example, it was written so detailed that we could really work towards it, and that we really could find shots that linked to each other on different worlds. Also to find little light cues, like flares coming in the wedding, and then a flare that takes over in the adventure, and to link scenes visually with or light or camera moves, it's because the scripts were written so well that it was possible.
Yeah. Did you feel any pressure coming into this, as it's a large, some people have called it the best of all of the Star Wars sort of franchise series that have ever been on Disney Plus. Some people even have compared it favorably to Star Wars movies the last few years. Was there any pressure going into this, or was it excitement? How was it taking on this level of project?
Well, of course, I was excited, and when they called me for it, and especially because it's a prequel to my favorite Star Wars movie. But I think from the moment you're into the project, I think the first week when I was walking around Pinewood and seeing the history over there, I was a little bit overwhelmed. But it was gone the second week actually, and then you're in work and it's like every other job for me. Then you're trying to do something as good as possible.
Well, let's get into it a little bit more. How did this job come to be for you? How did you, it sounds like you just met the director, so it didn't come that way. How did you and Andor season two end up connecting?
Thanks to David Mianti. He tried to introduce me to the production on the first season, but it didn't really work. Second season, he did it again. And it worked, which was good. I think maybe also because of, in between both seasons, I did Lupin, a French show that
had quite a bit of
success.
I hear people mostly call it, I hear most people call it Lupin. But yes, of course, Yeah, exactly. But it was a big hit. It was a big hit on Netflix. And do I recall correctly, you got an ASC nomination for that as well, too, for your work? No, it was everyone talked about how beautiful the show was. And I know it was using some new anamorphic lenses from PS Technic. There was a lot of talk when Lupin was hot on the Netflix charts. It was there, in the top 10 for a very long time. So anyway, sorry.
So maybe that helped also a little bit, but it's mainly because of David. We working on the job in France, we had such a good connection that we kept in touch and then voila.
It's a perfect testament to, because you never know where your next gig is coming from, so you never know, and it's great that you had a good connection. Let's talk a little bit more specifically about one of the episodes of Andor season two, and I want to talk about episode three, Harvest. There's a lot of things going on in this episode. You've got some intrigue. This show is filled with intrigue, but the intrigue between what's happening on the harvest planet, where you've got all kinds of potential danger going on. You've got Cassian and the TIE Avenger. You've got a wedding going on, Chandrilla. There's so much stuff going on in this episode, and the cross cuts between them. Talk about how you they say the only way to eat an elephant is one bite at a time. You got a lot of stuff going on here. Can you talk a little bit just about the logistics of trying to get this episode made?
It was a difficult one because all those bits were shot on a big time span. It was written like you see it in the edit at the end. It's a bit over here, a bit over there. So we really, really meticulously prepped all those scenes, and it's from, especially all the adventure stuff was really. It's on the rig. We had the Avenger in the fields.
Mm. Like suspended from a crane or something? Or from a, yeah.
Well, in the field, we dropped it in the fields. Working in a grain field is like working in the snow. So you have to put something and then see, okay, what's the axis from here? Because otherwise we will see our footsteps. And so it was really... Yeah, we had to plan it really into the maximum detail. And like I mentioned before, it was really important for us to tie those scenes together and to find ways to tie everything together. And the good thing was Tony already had the music. They already worked on the music, so we had the music and we used it really to time everything and to tie it together.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the wedding in particular, because it's really sort of this lavish ceremony that's cross-cut against the other things. What was What was your idea going into to this wedding? Because this is like, you know, it's creating a culture that we've never seen in the Star Wars universe before. We don't know anything really about any of this. You kind of have a blank slate. What was, I know you worked with production design, art department, all of those things, but talk a little bit about taking this sequence and bringing it to life.
The first time we read the final wedding sequence with Harry was, yeah, we were reading it as a night scene, or it was written as a night scene in first draft. I don't remember anymore, but we were, and Tony had mentioned, I should feel like it's a nightclub and everything is going really to top and she's losing it. So we were thinking, okay, what are we going to do light-wise and just feel-wise to make it something interesting that fits in the world of Chandrila, which is quite chic, and also fits in the world of Star Wars. So we went looking for it, and then in one of the meetings, Tony said, yeah, but guys, it should be a day scene. It's a day scene, it's important because it intercuts with the other scenes. And for us it was, okay, a day scene that feels like a nightclub. How are we going to do that? So then we went looking. I went looking for mood boards. For moods. And I ended up with the idea of trying to tell a time-lapse light-wise. So in the beginning of the wedding, the sun is quite high, it's bright outside. The sun is, during the wedding, the sun is going lower and lower and lower until the end when the sun is just on the horizon, peeping inside and making it super flary, which helped us to give the feel of, you know, we didn't have strobes or party lights, but it gave us something special to play with. And the way we shot it was also, we did a lot of circular movements around her. We had two Steadicams, one with a wider lens and one with a long zoom lens. It was a heavy, heavy Steadicam rig where we played with, yeah, just every time trying to stay with her and making her feel dizzy. And I think it worked quite well, actually.
I know that it worked quite well because, you know, the official Star Wars YouTube channel released the dance sequence from this the episode for 1 hour. It made me wonder how much you actually shot or how much of it is, you know, multiple camera angles cut together and whatnot to extend this out. But did you shoot an hour's worth of footage?
The real dance scene, we shot it in 1 day.
Again. Yeah.
Of course, the leading up and everything else were on other days, but the scene where she starts dancing and it starts going out of control is 1 day. And we had two Steadicams, and I was on a Technocrane to do some wide shots so I could also supervise the other two cameras. And Ari was on the zoom of the Steadicam. But it was, we did a lot of rehearsals also. We did rehearsals with the dancers, and me and Ari, we were walking with our Artemis looking for shots and just, okay, how are we going to film it? We were recording it and then putting it together to see, okay, does it work or not? So there was a lot of planning in it, but with some room for nice moments and nice glimpses of frames.
There's an awful lot of lens flare too. There's a lot of wonderful moments and stuff that happen in there. And by evidence too, if you have already seen this series and you're listening to the sound of my voice, you can also go to YouTube and now watch this hour long version that's been extracted essentially from the dance number, which is a lot of fun. We'll put a link to it in the show notes over at Cam Noir. Christoph, I want to get into more of your story of how this all came to be for you. You've been shooting for quite a while. I took a look at your IMDb page. I know that you know, you've DP'd a lot of projects. Tell us your backstory. How did you get the bug for this? When did you decide that being a cinematographer was something that you could do for a living?
I think from my first workshop in the film school in Brussels. I remember the first year at the film school. It's a general year. You do some editing, you do some sound mixing, you do some camera work and lighting. But from the moment I had a camera in my hands and I started lighting a scene, I had something. this is really something I want to do. And in the beginning, after school, I started as a second camera assistant and camera assistant. But at the same time, because I was impatient, I also started doing camera work for television, just for even reality, documentaries. I did a bit of everything. And actually, I'm happy I did it because I also learned a lot of those things. It's from documentary, you learn telling a story, also learn looking for nice frames, which are lit by themselves. And from reality, you learn editing in your head quickly and blocking a scene. Blocking a scene without changing something. So it's just, you learn really well editing in your head with it.
Yeah, I want to dig into that a little bit deeper because I think that is the thing that most people don't realize that cinematographers have to be so good at. You have to be so good at taking these pieces and understanding in your head how they're going to fit together. Can you talk about a little bit when you had this realization or when you realized that it's a huge part of the job is understanding the flow of of one shot to another?
I think one of the shows I did in Belgium, Cordon, it's called Cordon, with the director Tim Milans. It's a show where we really worked hard on shot listing and blocking scenes and we shortlisted every scene, but then when we were rehearsing the scene, he was putting like a theater play in place. And I remember I was sitting in a corner watching until the scene took shape. And from the moment it took shape, I had a stills camera with the same lenses and the same sensor size as the ARRI. And I started during the rehearsal taking pictures and taking shots and then looking on the camera, how does this cut together? We took a moment with the director and I showed him all those things. And I think for me, it's really important that when I start a scene that I know where it's going. It's really difficult for me to start a scene without seeing where it goes, edit twice, and which shots are still coming. And I think it's on that show that I realized how important it was.
Do you feel like it's a muscle that you have to keep exercising, or is it something that once you've just kind of got it, you've got it, you know all the tricks? I mean, I'm asking you some questions about this because I always felt like when I was shooting stuff that was narrative or whatnot, what a big deal it was and how much work that I had to do to really pay attention to this. And it's not something I feel like many DPs talk about. They don't talk about sometimes people have the attitude of like, oh, it's the editor or someone else will figure this out and the script supervisor. And but no, I think to do really, really well, you've got to have confidence in your framing, confidence in the way that you're going to be able to start a scene in one place and end somewhere else and have everything cut along the way and have it work. Tell me, I mean, since you brought this up, I'd love to hear more about what you think about how much you have to keep your craft sharp, how much you have to do for this.
Keep it sharp because film language is evolving. And when I started, handheld was a real thing. Now handheld does not use a lot anymore. Now it's one takers. So it's I think you need to keep evolving, and it's also important for me to keep evolving because the moment that I feel I'm doing something as a routine, then I want to do something else. I need to have the feeling that I'm learning every time, and every director is different. For example, I was talking about Tim Milans. He really likes to do a long blocking and searching for shots, but for him the position of the actors is more the freedom of the actors is important, but for other directors really precise framing is important, and so it depends from situation to situation, so you need to adapt and you need to evolve also, and to every story is different and needs to be told differently.
Yeah, I was looking through your filmography. You've done a lot of work in Europe and a lot of television. What would you say is defining about your work as a cinematographer?
I feel more attracted towards natural lighting, and for example, I did a French show. The story took place in Kazakhstan in the desert, and that's where I feel at home. Actually, for all it's in working with the natural lights and also the darker scenes. I love to just to shoot dark scenes and to make it mysterious. That's the thing I'm attracted to the most. But at the same time, sometimes it's also good and it feels good to do, for example, like the wedding, which is totally not that. It's brighter. It's a little bit more polished. Mm-hmm. I like the mix to do both, but I'm most attracted to the more natural, darker stuff.
Mm, okay, gotcha. Yeah. Didn't get a chance to flex that muscle too many times in Andor. Less handheld, less gritty, less dark, but lots of really, really wonderful looking stuff. I think it's a real triumph from a visual perspective, which is lovely. It's just such a great looking show. We only have a couple minutes left here, but before we go, I want to find out where can people find you? Do you have a website? Do you do an Instagram? Do you do anything like that?
I have a basic website, and Instagram account, but to be honest, I'm not super active on it.
What's that? Well, we'll go ahead and put links to both your website and the Instagram over at our official website, which is camnoir.com. Christoph, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a great conversation. I can't wait to see what you do next.
Pleasure. Thank you.
So that was Christoph Nunez. Hey, thanks so much for being on the show. It was great chatting with you. I can't wait to see what you do next. So, Ben, it is bill paying time. We have to thank our fine friends over at Arri, makers of all kinds of incredible cameras, lenses, lights. Today, I want to talk about the Enzo lenses. I got a chance to use them when I was in Korea about 2 weeks ago. And holy crap, this was the first time I actually got to use them on something real. And they are remarkably small and remarkably high quality little lenses. I would say that they are these sort of heir apparent to the Ultra Primes, which are the most popular set of lenses made for professional cinema in the world. I know there's more than 20,000 of those lenses worldwide, and the Enzos seem to be building on that legacy, and they offer a whole lot of really advanced features and functions. We're going to put a link to the lenses inside the show notes over at Cam Noir. Of course, you can get them over at Hot Rod Cameras. They are backordered by a fair bit right now. You have to place a non-refundable deposit in order to get a hold of these. And I do know that the prices just went up, which is one of those things. So it is worth checking them out, though, especially if you were looking for premium, relatively small lenses that are in the same sort of family as like Signature Primes, but are not Signature Primes. They're a little bit slower, they're significantly smaller, but they have a really spectacular modern, but I want to say controlled modern look, which of course can be modified through the use of all of these different attachments that they offer for the lenses. If you have been looking for a new set of lenses, definitely take a look at the Arri Enzo series. They're fantastic. And of course, you can get them over at Hot Rod Cameras.
And now, Short Ends.
So Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's when we talk about our pet obsessions of the week. It can be anything. What is your short end? What are you obsessed about?
I stumbled across a killer documentary that you can watch right now for free on Tubi. It's called Friedkin Uncut. Now, people who listen to this a lot and memorize, as they should, everything I ever talk about, because it's the most important stuff, might remember that I talked about another documentary about William Friedkin called Leap of Faith, which was literally just a feature-length documentary about William Friedkin talking about every artistic decision that went into The Exorcist. And it's great. Friedkin Uncut is kind of a full career retrospective of William Friedkin from 2018, directed by somebody named Francesco Zippel and shot by somebody named Marco Tomaselli. And they're like with William Friedkin in his house, And they also, but they also talked to a number of his key collaborators throughout the years, including Ellen Burstein. They talked to Willem Dafoe. Willem Dafoe has some of the greatest Willem Dafoe moments ever. But also, they talk about a lot of his contemporaries. So they talk to a bunch of his contemporaries. So it's like or Caleb Dashnell, who shot a bunch of his movies. But they talked to Dario Argento and Ellen Burstein and Francis Ford Coppola and Wes Anderson. Not a contemporary of his at all, but influenced by him. Matthew McConaughey was in Killer Joe, and Philip Kaufman, who to me himself should be the subject of a documentary. I think Philip Kaufman is one of the most fascinating directors of that time period. But it kind of goes deeply into the process that Friedkin went through. Friedkin, you know, and I have this on good authority. I know someone who worked very closely with him. Kind of notorious screamer, not always the most pleasant person to work with, but definitely. You know, his films, you know, including things like The French Connection, The Exorcist, et cetera, like really To Live and Die in L.A., they defined an era, they defined a place. And even his movies like Cruising, which had a hard time finding a home at the time, have kind of been, you know, reassessed. And they talk a great deal about his process. And also, William Friedkin, he just has no fucks to give. He just kind of lets it rip and says his opinion the way that exactly as it occurs to him. And maybe that's what made him a screamer. Maybe, you know, you don't want to be on the business end of that. But with something was bullshit, he would call it out as such. And he was a fascinating filmmaker and a fascinating man. And I think this would pair well with A Leap of Faith if what you wanted was three straight hours of William Friedkin, you know, in his extremely excited tones, talking about the things that make him excited creatively. So definitely check it out for free on Tubi. Go get it.
Yeah, that's really cool. You know, I know one person who worked with Friedkin on To Live and Die in L.A., and he told me that was the movie that made him quit the industry.
Oh, really? So,
yes, and told me all sorts of, like, you know, stories in confidence that I should not repeat on a podcast. But yes, that, very specifically about Friedkin, about how he that life was too short. He shouldn't do this anymore. But he said one of the things, and I don't think this is a problem, me sharing that, that the decision was made. There's a Ferrari that's featured in that movie. There's a couple of them, actually. And at one point he was handed like $80,000 and told to go buy a Ferrari for like the scene that they were shooting later that day. So he had to go out to the dealership and like literally show up with like $80,000 in cash and buy a Ferrari and then drive it back to set so they could
like you do. Well, yeah, the person who I know who worked for him was an editor who had worked for him on several projects, and he said that he only got the business end of him being a screamer once. But he saw it, and I said to him, like, well, do you think he got more out of people by being a screamer, expecting him to say, no, people, you know, are good and they want to work and they'll do a good job. And you don't need to lose the cool. But actually, he said, oh, my God. Yeah. People would do anything to avoid getting yelled at by him. But what do you do? I mean, I think it was also like a radically different era of filmmaking. And I think if today, if anyone behaved like that today, audio would leak and it would end their career. Or in the case of David O. Russell, they would just get to keep making movies forever and ever, and it would have no effect on their career. But I feel like you, for the most part, people can't get away with that anymore, and probably shouldn't. But you know, that doesn't take away from the fact that he made so many I only recently rewatched The French Connection, and that movie, you know, it feels like a snapshot of its time, but like those chase scenes feel like real and dangerous. And you know why? It's because they were real. They were like stealing a car chase on the streets of New York. It's not exactly what you would do, but they did it. And I don't know. I mean, I just think that there's like a certain aesthetic and a certain creative approach, not the yelling part of the creative approach, but just the kind of thinking that he put into everything, that I feel like it's good to revisit it. I'm not saying that no one's doing that today. A lot of people are doing different things today.
Yeah. But and I don't know if we should necessarily be idolizing or rewarding some of that behavior, but well, it's like, it is interesting to see
he,
that.
He died a few years ago and he receives no benefit from us rewarding the films themselves. Let's put it this way. And to me, it's not like he's Roman Polanski and committed a horrible crime. He was kind of a dick to work with. And that's a different thing, you know? Anyway, Ilya, what is your short end besides sleep? Because I know you're kind of jet lagged still.
Jet lag is an understatement, but yes, coming up this week is starting Friday and Saturday is Cine Gear. Cine Gear is sort of the preeminent event for the technology side of the motion picture industry. And by technology side, I'm talking about the production technology. It takes place this year at Universal on the back lot. Hot Rod Cameras, my company, is going to have a booth there inside Stage 3031. It's a great booth. We're right across from Blackmagic. Interesting to note that Cinegear is doing something different this year, which I think it's going to be a little bit controversial. I think there's some people who probably don't realize it, but they attract, I'm going to say, probably in the neighborhood of 10,000 people who come to this event. And it's always been a free event if you registered in advance. This year, there was no free admission. You have to know someone. They made it like Hollywood. You have to know someone if you want free admission. So they were charging $25 up until a couple of days ago. It's now $75 if you'd like to go. Look, I still have a half a dozen passes that I can give out to people. If there's anyone listening to this who are fans of the podcast and did not register and are coming out to Cinegear, shoot me a message on LinkedIn or Instagram and I need your email address, your first and last name, but I'll give you one of those passes that I have left because it seems really criminal to me. And I think the people who are the least suspecting, who do like to go to a free event and socialize and network and everything else, are going to be the ones who stay home. So I don't really know what the crowd's going to be like. It might not be crowded at all. But there is a free event that takes place the day after Cinegear that some might argue is even more fun, called Cine Beer. It takes place over at Hot Rod Cameras, and Cine Beer this year is becoming the Cine Beer Brunch. It starts at 11 a.m., goes till 2 p.m. If you are in the greater Los Angeles or Burbank area and you're like, boy, Cinegear, yeah, that was a lot of work and maybe a lot of money. You can actually win things at Cine Beer. We give away about $10,000 worth of prizes. We've got a bunch of sponsors. And because it's brunch, there's going to be a really, really awesome bit of brunch type food. And of course, because it is Cine Beer, there will be beer. Beer go with brunch? Yes, it does. It will go there. Beer mimosas are a thing, and I'm told to expect beer mimosas at the Cine Beer brunch.
I don't drink, but so, that sounds horrific.
There is some sort of recipe that is supposedly not terrible, but it's
I'm just imagining orange juice mixed into your beer.
Yeah, I think it's something more like a Hefeweizen, and it's sort of like slightly orange. It's like there's something about it that is supposed to be
you guys have fun. I might stop by, but I won't be drinking that or any alcohol.
You do need to pre-register for Cine Beer. Cine Beer is nearly sold out. 99% of the tickets are now gone, even though it is free. We will put a link to those tickets over at Cam Noir, the show notes. Please register if you come by and have a beer or mosa. Say hello. Say, come enjoy. Maybe you'll win something. We do give away all those prizes. So technically, this season right now, this sort of like a trade show bit of the season, we're kind of at the tail end of it. It really starts around April, and then technically the shows go year round, but really the sort of like West Coast LA ones, starting with NAB, sort of end with Cinegear, and there's a ton of parties that go along with it. So anyone out there who does want to go to the parties and doesn't know about them, there's a really awesome WhatsApp group. If you message me to any of these places, I can connect you with the WhatsApp group, and then you get the party list so you can go to all the parties. So
excellent.
Anyway, so Ben, I think that just about does it for this episode. Where can people find you if they want to track you down?
You can find me at benrock.com, and you'll find all my socials on there. I'm also on Blue Sky. I don't think benrock.com links to Blue Sky yet. But LinkedIn, the huge. Check out my reel. Say hi. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
Well, this week you can find me at both Cinegear and Cinebeer, but the rest of the time you can find me at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. And that's I think where people are finding me right now. So Ben, this show would not have been possible without the help of a whole lot of people.
Or at least three.
Three other people. Who are those other people? And
Alana Cody, our intrepid producer, is many people at once. She wears a lot of hats for us, and she sets up all these kick-ass interviews. And where would we be without her? Nowhere. Nowhere is where
I did one. I did one yesterday. I did actually two yesterday. I did two yesterday. In fact, one in person in Portland, which is crazy.
I didn't even know that they had people to talk to in Portland. Anyway, except you. So we should thank her. We got to thank our editor, Charlie Nix, who hopefully we didn't make too horrible of a procedure here for this time. And lastly, but never least, we got to thank Kays Alatrachi, our composer, and also your fill-in co-host when he wasn't my fill-in co-host.
Our Joan Rivers.
Yes, our Joan Rivers, our Gary Shandling, our Jerry Seinfeld. Our permanent, I don't want to say Jay Leno, because he ended up getting the gig.
That's right. He got the gig.
Thanks to Kays. Check him out at musicbykays.com. Also, he has that YouTube channel. Yeah. Kays Labs, where you can go see Kays fix synthesizers and learn all about synthesizers. It's some pretty hardcore nerdy stuff. I'm not going to lie.
But you know what? Kays is a hardcore nerd.
Oh, absolutely. So, Ilya, would you like to take us out?
Oh, would I?
Hunchback.
Right to sleep. All right. Thanks for tuning in.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.